It was Maya Angelou who said, "People will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel." Hi, this is Ginger, advisor at 12listen.com and host of my new show, Heart Matters, at 12radio.com. Heart Matters is a place where we explore all matters of the heart, anything that has real meaning to you. Heart Matters will be live every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific. It's my hope that Heart Matters becomes more than just a weekly radio show, but a place that leaves you feeling heard in all matters of the heart, because your heart matters. May you always leave here feeling heard in all matters of the heart, because, well, your heart matters. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heart Matters. I am so glad you are here, and I know the listeners that you have been listening to me rave and rave on and on for weeks about our special guest, Ravinder Taylor. She is finally here if you're listening live tonight, and if you're listening in the on-demand, please check that out. But I'm so excited. I know that all the listeners have heard it for weeks now because it's all I've been raving about. But I did want to do a little short introduction about her in case you're just now tuning into the show and you've missed the other shows. So Ravinder Taylor, she is the author of the amazing new book, Mind Training. And for the past 30 years, she's been researching and analyzing self-help modalities. She's utilized her learning in thousands of interactions with individuals seeking guidance for breaking through blocks to success in their lives. And who couldn't use that? Many have praised her insights and reported great success when following her recommendations. In addition to all this, she has been working alongside Eldon Taylor on each of his books, and she is the co-author of over 200 personal motivation audio programs and 2 books. That's quite a feat. She also does motivational nudges to empower your life and peripheral perception via subliminal stimuli. She's a Bachelor of Science degree in microbiology from the University College of Wales, and she's an ordained interdenominational minister. She's completed a 3-year training course at the National College of Hypnosis and Psychotherapy in the UK. So I can't wait to have Ravinder on. And without further ado, I want to introduce our special guest, Ravinder Taylor. Hi, Ravinder. How are you?
Hi, Ginger. I am doing well. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to share with you.
Oh, I'm so excited. Like I said, the listeners have been hearing me rave about you for weeks, and just because we've been so excited. So they know a little bit about you, but, you know, of course, we really want to dive into your amazing book, and I really want to familiarize the listeners with that. But when we get started, I was wondering, Ravinder, if you could maybe just give a little brief summary of just a little bit about your background. I told them a little bit in the introduction, but if there's anything I missed that you'd like to add, we can add that, certainly.
My background was pretty hard science. I came into this, I was working in a path lab at the time, and then I became introduced to the idea of hypnosis. There was a presentation that was held at the hospital I was in, and I was fascinated by some of the things that they were talking about, the kinds of effects of the mind, or how easy it is to take control of the mind. And, you know, the whole process of hypnosis is fascinating. But there was actually a particular story that was shared with us where there was a woman who had a pain in her arm for years and years and years. And she had been to see all the doctors, all the experts, all the specialists, and they were unable to help her. So eventually she went to see this hypnotherapist. And under hypnotherapy, they had an uncovering of some emotional event that she had put in the background. You know, she had disregarded it. It was old news. It had been a big deal at the time, but it was in the past. And that was what came up as being the cause of her pain. The woman didn't believe in it particularly. She went home that night. The following day, she called the hypnotherapist back and said the pain was gone.
Wow.
It had actually gone immediately, but she didn't believe it.
Right.
So she had waited all night, and then she called the following day. So the very idea that the mind has this kind of power over us, it can heal us, it can make us sick. That all taught me the importance of valuing our minds. So that's pretty much where it all started.
I love that. And, you know, as you share that story, I think of Brian Weiss, how he shares that with his client. Like, she had done all this work of psychology, psychotherapy for years, and it wasn't until she went through hypnosis that it helped her, and like regression. But like, what is fascinating, and what we're finding more and more research about, which I know you'll share later because you have such a comprehensive book with so many techniques with the mind training and things like that, is just that power of the mind and like how stored emotions can get in our body, and like really like just the amazing power of our mind. It's like I think it's underrated in many events, and like I think your book really gives a good account of just how powerful our mind is, and you have so many good techniques. So I would love for the listeners to hear, like, what inspired you to write this book? Why did you write the book? Like, as you were, you know, you told us a little bit about your background, but how did the book come about per se?
You know, as we said, my husband is Eldon Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
He's a New York Times bestselling author. He's considered one of the world's experts in preconscious processing. So I've been working with him in the background for the last 30 plus years. So I've helped do the research. I've helped do some ghostwriting on his books. I do all the editing. But then one day I came across a paper that talked about a 12-minute meditation that was having amazing results when it came to cognitive abilities, well-being, memory, with great potential for, you know, if not actually reversing dementia and Alzheimer's, but at least assisting in those areas. And I looked at this paper and it was really well done. It's done by, you know, some highly reputable scientists at some major universities. It was published in a, you know, peer-reviewed journal. And I looked at all the details. There is no doubt in my mind that this meditation worked. However, it was publicized widely on the web. I mean, everyone was talking about it. Maybe you're familiar with it. Mm-hmm. They often call it Satyanama.
Mm-hmm.
But I looked at these explanations for it, and I knew it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I was brought up Sikh, and Satyanama sounds very much to me like Satnam, which is one of the most basic parts of the Sikh faith.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not a practicing Sikh anymore, but sometimes these things just become a part of you. And Satnam means true name. And it was being put out there that Satyanama meant something like birth, life, death, rebirth, which it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. And if you look it up now, Ginger, mm-hmm. you will find, if you actually go to the source, you will find that they are not reporting that anymore. They don't say that it means birth, life, death, rebirth. It's not Sanskrit for, it's not, you know, it is just a really basic part of the Sikh faith. And so I looked at that and thought, okay, well, that is wrong. And then one of the explanations that I came across too, you know, I said, I went to the source, I got all the information, but they were talking about when you pronounce the word Satyanama, you're activating different acupressure points in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But the word is totally different. Your mouth, the structure of your mouth, as you say, Satyanama, is very different to Satnam.
Right.
Even if you break Satnam down into four syllables, it's Satnam, not mm-hmm. Satyanama. Your mouth is totally different. So that part didn't hold. So I was looking at how it all worked. And that's really what triggered it off. There are so many self-help techniques out there where, you know, perhaps the techniques work, perhaps, you know, there is some basis for it, but the explanations can be wrong. And when you don't know exactly why you're doing what you're doing, you don't have any control over it. So this meditation worked, but was it possible to take the principles of the meditation and personalize it? So Satanama is like the 4-4 time. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. You know,
right?
That when you say that slowly, that's gonna entrain the brain. Mm-hmm. When you have something to focus on, so having to actually utter the words, that focuses your mind. You know how difficult it is to empty your mind when you're trying to do a meditation? It's really hard to create a blank mind. And so this meditation doesn't try to. It gives you something to focus on. You have the focus of the words, you have the focus of the hand movements, and they don't have to be the specific mudras that they put forward. It's just having something to focus on. So it was that entire process, and then I wanted to see how to extend that into other areas. So I started writing a book myself that I titled initially as Bottling the Placebo Effect, the Real Secret to Health, Wealth, and the Fountain of Youth.
I love that title.
I started working on that while Eldon started work on his following book, and that was on mind training. He's ahead of me, you know, he's written lots of books. He gets his work done a whole lot faster than I do when it comes to that kind of work. So he handed me the outline for his book, and I realized how much overlap there was between the two. Mm-hmm. The real difference came in the way that I was bringing in my own perspective, my own experiences with everything, my own passions, you know, the type of research that I enjoy following the most, you know, that was where it really differed. So we ended up deciding, okay, rather than writing two books that talk about the same issues just from different angles, why not combine them both and make the book even better? And I think that's what we did.
Absolutely. And I love how the two are so cohesive and meshed together of the two things. And like, as you talked about the focus on meditation, for someone that's meditated on and off for years and still has struggled with meditation, you know, having something like that focus, it makes such a difference. It's a game changer when you have those kind of tools to use, like with meditation, you know, like you talked about with that, like something to focus on as well. So I definitely appreciate that. And since we're talking about, like, you know, just like misinformation and like how, because, you know, now, like with technology, there's so many information on various social media, and sometimes it's really hard to differentiate with, you know, an information overload, like what is myth and fact. Like, you know, you shared that about the book and why you were inspired to write it, but are there any other stories that you can share that are like more myth than fact, that we may think, oh well, that is a fact, but in all actuality, like through your research through this book and other areas, that you found out to be actually a myth?
Absolutely, there are, you know, especially in the area of self-improvement. Mm-hmm. One of the common myths out there has to do with Roger Bannister and the 4-minute mile. The way the story gets told frequently is that up until 1954, people didn't believe that it was possible to break the 4-minute mile, but then Roger Bannister came along and he believed it and he did it. And because he did it, everybody else then believed that it was possible to do. And mm-hmm. because Roger Bannister had done it, 6 weeks later, John Landry broke the 4-minute mile as well. In fact, he actually beat Roger Bannister's mile. And that all comes down to belief. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as it gets taught, you're taught, just believe. Well, when you look at that, that isn't true. Mm-hmm. That absolutely isn't true. And I think that gives people false hope. Let me expand on that for you. Sure. I ran a marathon myself in 2018. Mm-hmm. I was inspired because a friend of mine had run a marathon, but my training actually began in 2013. Up until that point, for several decades prior to that, I had not run anywhere. You know, perhaps I ran across a parking lot, but that would be it. I had not done any running whatsoever. So I had to start off really slow. So the training I did, it began with, well, you run for 1 minute, you walk for 1 minute, you run for 1 minute, you walk for 1 minute. And it built up slowly. And I remember being so proud when I reached the 10-minute mark, when I could run for 10 minutes and then walk for one. And I did that 4 times. So there's a lot of training. And, you know, I did that in the first year. But going up from doing that to doing 26 miles, well, that took a whole lot more training. So in the case of Roger Bannister and John Landry, they broke the 4 minute mile in 1954. But Roger Bannister began training in 1946. And John Landry started training in 1949. They would have worked up to it. It definitely took some belief, because obviously if you're going to try to break a world record, you have to believe that it's possible. Right. So definitely you have an element of belief, but it also takes a great deal of discipline, a great deal of sacrifice, a great deal of hard work. There was a clip that I saw online not long ago of Tom Brady. Now, you're familiar with Tom Brady. You know, he's got seven Super Bowl rings, so he's definitely up there. Right. And he talks about it's hard. You do the hard work. You have to sacrifice. You can't eat that extra piece of cake that everyone else is enjoying. You have to watch your diet. When your partner's in bed asleep, you have to get up early in the morning to go train. You have to go out there even when you're hurting, when you're tired, when you're just not in the mood. It's hard work. And both Roger Bannister and John Landry would have done the same thing. So John Landry breaking the 4 minute mile didn't have anything to do with Roger Bannister. They were both training at the same time. Roger Bannister's race just came first. You know, quite honestly, if it had been the other way around, maybe John Landry would have broken it first and we wouldn't have any idea of Roger Bannister's name, because John Landry beat him.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
He actually, you know, he did the race 1.5 seconds faster. So those kinds of myths out there, I think they give people false hope. They expect that the answers are going to be simple. They don't think that there's anything else they have to do. And so they try the technique, it doesn't work, and so they walk away. And that, I think, is the real danger, because there are so many self-help techniques. As you've said, mind training covers a great deal, you know, a large number of techniques. But I try to give the explanations for everything in there. So yeah, there are myths out there, and they do a whole lot more harm than good, because they're going to put people off. People aren't going to do it. They're going to be disappointed. And even worse than that, they can actually end up feeling deficient in the process. There is this fear that, well, other people have done it and they're successful, but I couldn't do it, so I must be less than. And that doesn't help anyone in a self-empowerment journey.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely correct, Ravinder. As like you even think of this, I think of that, how that broadens on like to like fad diets, like where they have celebrity endorsements and they think if they eat this like gummy or pill, like they're going to have instant results, but like they don't factor in, you got to change your diet, you got to exercise. You know, it's kind of like those myths that you talk about, like where you're getting more myths than fact. Like, you know, like you talked about with Roger Bannister and the race, a lot of times social media will, you know, put this front, like that you can have like instant results, and they fail to share the results. So I thought that was a really good example that you had in the book of that. So I love that. And another thing too that I found fascinating, what is like most of us have heard of placebo pills and placebo effect, but you took it a step further, like across cultures, like how certain colors of pills or shapes would prompt various thoughts with them, and it varied across cultures. So I was wondering if you could kind of go in depth a little bit more for the audience about, like, with that placebo response, like some of the best evidence that you found for the power in the mind, and then how our culture influences our mind and our belief, and why does that happen?
Yes, an important part of mind training is understanding how powerful your mind is. When you have a true understanding of that, you're a whole lot more likely to do the work that is involved to empower yourself. So the earlier work that I came across was with dissociative identity disorder. And I came across these different examples where maybe a person was diabetic in one personality, but not in the other, or the eye color was different in one personality than the other. There was also examples where a person would have different cycles, periods, mm-hmm. Would have different ones for each of the personalities that she had. Now, these examples were incredible. I dug deep into them. They were, you know, reported by respectable doctors. I think they were reported in the New York Times. This, I think, was back in the 50s, if I'm remembering correctly. Don't quote me on that bit. So these stories were rather fantastic, but I wanted something a whole lot more solid, a whole lot more real. And as you've pointed out, that comes with the work on placebo. Placebo is the idea that the belief that a pill is going to help you actually does help you. Mm-hmm. So you start getting some of the positive benefits from it. And what they found with the placebo was there are differences depending on if it's a pill or if it's a capsule, or what color the pill is. If it's a red pill, that's normally considered to be more of a stimulant. If it's a white pill, that's considered to be more of an analgesic. So we have these things that go across the board. But one of the things that I found really interesting is when you look across cultures and the kind of placebo effect. So one thing that I found disquieting, I haven't quite figured out what to do with this little piece of information, but there is the idea that in America, Black Americans will look at a white pill and think it's a stimulant, mm-hmm. whereas they will look at a black pill and think it's an analgesic. But a Caucasian person will think the other way around. They will look at the white pill as being the analgesic and the black pill as being a stimulant. And that speaks to really, you know, deeply buried beliefs about cultures. And so that piece of that little bit of information, as I said, I found that disquieting. But you go across cultures too. So in Germany, the placebo response to hypertensive drugs is low. You look at gastric ulcers in Brazil, the placebo response there is low, but in Germany it's high. Mm-hmm. So what kind of information are we taking in just that surrounds us, just part of our enculturation, the different countries that you're in, how would that affect the kind of placebo response? Well, it's going to be beliefs about colors, beliefs about therapies, beliefs about different illnesses, but it all becomes part of your subconscious mind. And that is where the answers to all of this stuff lies. So It really highlights how deep the enculturation process is and how our beliefs are being shaped without us being aware of it.
Absolutely. And I found that fascinating as well. And I kind of wanted to go back to a little bit that you were talking about earlier, which I found fascinating on a personal level as well. When you talk about the dissociative identity disorder, some people may know that as multiple personalities.
Yes.
And Like since I was young, I was diagnosed that I had an allergy to fruit, so I couldn't eat fruit. And then, of course, I read your example about this person with multiple personalities. They were severely allergic to orange juice, got a rash and everything. But one of those personalities could drink the orange juice, no rash, anything. And so it shows just the extreme power of the mind. Like, because an allergy, you usually don't think about those things, or I don't at least, but like it really just shows like the power of the mind. That really blew me away, that example that you shared of that.
In that example, as I said, those were extreme examples. I began there. I
Right.
much prefer to focus on the stuff that is more heavily researched, which is why I ended up going to the placebo. But when it comes to allergies, there is definitely a psychosomatic component to that. There has been a great deal of work done on that. I don't cover that in mind training. Perhaps that was an oversight on my part. But yes, allergies can be influenced by your beliefs.
It was fascinating, and like the placebos with the colors, I've been always been an avid psychology student, and I'd never read that, and that was just fascinating that you shared that, and especially like you said, across different cultures and how we viewed them as like stimulants or analgesics, just very fascinating. So I'm so glad that you put that in the book and shared that with the readers so they can go more in depth with that. And since we're talking about the book, Ravinder, I was wondering if you could tell them a little bit what mind training is about, and what do you hope the readers are going to get from this book when they read it? What are you hoping they will receive?
For me, the most important part actually comes in the subtitle, The Science of Self-Empowerment. I wanted the reader to have all the tools there. And to do that, I said, first of all, you have to appreciate how powerful your mind is, but then you have to learn how it works. There is all of this information in your subconscious mind, and you have to dig down into that to find out why it's important, why it's significant, what the kind of effects are. You can be aware of information, you can know something on a superficial level, but when you know it deep down, then it becomes a part of you. And that is what mind training is about. It's about having a deeper understanding of all of this stuff. So these aren't special techniques. It's not like you go once a week to hear someone speak. I wanted techniques that you can incorporate into your everyday life. These aren't things that you have that will take a great deal of time. The one that takes the longest time is the meditation, and even there, we have that compressed down to 12 minutes. And I do show you, as I said, how to personalize that for yourself. But I wanted tools that people could incorporate just in their normal everyday lives that would help them feel better now, would start improving their lives right now. There are lots of things that you can do today that can have far-reaching consequences. So all of these techniques, the more positivity that you practice today, the more positivity you will experience tomorrow and down the highway. There is a researcher, Fredrickson and Joyner, they were looking at, positivity, positive thinking and the kinds of effects that has. And what Fredrickson called it was the upward spiral effect. And I found that just a beautiful phrase, because I can just picture you just constantly are getting better, you're going higher and higher, and the spiral is kind of a flow that just takes you forward, it expands, it just cuts across your life in all of these different areas. So I wanted to make the book a truly, a book about self-empowerment. And you do that by internalizing all of this knowledge. You have to understand that all of this is in your subconscious mind. So you have to learn how to take care of your own subconscious mind, just as we saw with these different cultures and the placebo effect and how it varied in different countries. So you just have to be aware of everything that your subconscious mind is taking in, and you have to get into the driver's seat. If you don't do that, it'll get programmed for you, and you'll act like an automaton. You just respond to some of these things automatically. But the more you understand it, the more you take charge of it, and the greater effects that you have, the greater positive effects that you will see in your life, both today, tomorrow, 6 months, and a year. Putting these techniques into practice will definitely change the trajectory of your life, and it'll help you be to achieve more in whatever area. It'll improve your health, it'll eliminate self-destructive patterns, it'll supercharge success potential. But you just incorporate these things into your everyday life. And mind training, I do explain exactly how to do that. Every chapter, every aspect of the book comes with, at the end of each chapter, I will tell you what the important highlights of the chapter was. So you don't have to remember all the details, all the science, because that can be rather mind-boggling, but you do have to have a deep appreciation for how it all happens. So internalizing that knowledge and then choosing to take responsibility for your subconscious programming and then to implement all the changes. And I wanted to make that process just as smooth and as simple as possible. And I think I did a pretty good job actually with that. I've been hearing lots of compliments from people because there's lots of self-help books out there. They tell you what to do, but they don't explain why. Or there's lots of great psychology books that tell you how the mind works, and it's really fascinating, but they don't tell you what to do with it. I've actually tried to combine the two. I wanted to create a bridge between science and self-help.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting and fascinating things about it truly is self-help. When you read this book, you're not looking for like a guru to save you, or it's practical and it's applicable. And like you said, you have the key points, which summarizes the chapters well. And one of the things I absolutely enjoyed about it is how you have these practical exercises that they can actually apply at the end of the book, like to make sure that they're using that in everyday life, and they're practical. Anyone could use them. They're exercises that are very simple that you have laid out for them. So it very much is like you're really self-empowering them so they can do this healing, internally and utilize these steps, but they're also practical. They're not so far out of reach that they couldn't do them. They're very applicable and practical, and I really appreciated that.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for. Just want to make it practical and personal. I wanted
Right.
to make this re really, really personal for the user. You don't have to do all the techniques. You can pick and choose. You can tweak the techniques to suit your particular lifestyle, your particular needs, whatever it is. Hopefully, the idea is that it will empower you so that if you encounter an issue down the highway, and the more you pay attention to this, the more you realize these kinds of issues. But as you encounter them, you can stop and say, oh, okay, I've got this different issue. I hadn't looked at this before. I wonder where it comes from. I wonder where I can look for the answers. The answers are here in my subconscious mind. How long have I had this particular issue? It gives you the ability to be your own therapist in that regard.
Absolutely. And like I said, it's the epitome of self-help because you're definitely giving them all the tools to utilize to really have that journey to help themselves, which is fascinating. And I love that about it. So we're at the halfway mark, Ravinder. So everyone, we are going to take a short little break. But when we come back, please stick around because we're going to talk about the fascinating subject about free will. So please stick around. We're going to take a short little break. So get a beverage and come back because we're going to discuss free will.
Thank you. to the night it blends as fairies weave gentle moonbeams in their hands. Won't you open your heart? May our love never part. Come dance in the moon, silver beams, live forever in the
Hello everyone, we are back. I hope you enjoyed your break and that you got a cold or hot beverage. And I am back with Ravinder Taylor, and so glad that everyone has tuned in. We have been talking about her newest book called Mind Training, and we are back and we were getting ready to talk about a fascinating subject matter that has probably baffled humanity since inception, and that is free will. And she has written about free will in her book. So Ravinder, can you tell the audience, why does the question of free will matter?
Yeah, I'm happy to, Ginger. Mind Training is a very science-based book. I tried to keep it very scientific. I suppose I was deliberately avoiding the spiritual part of it. I wanted to keep everything very, very factual. Mm-hmm. However, when you read the book, you will find there are spiritual values that just keep on creeping up.
Mm-hmm.
They just appear there. And one of those areas has to do with free will. Now, many of the world's experts will tell you categorically that there's no such thing as free will. Robert Sapolsky in his book Determined, he covers it really extensively. He looks at all the different aspects that attribute to the fact that free will doesn't exist. And in a nutshell, what he's really saying is that for every action today, it has a precursor. And that has a precursor. So your genes will influence you. Your life experiences will influence you. The country that you're born in influences you. All of these things, there are just factors that keep on going. You can have two people in the same household, but their life experiences can be different, and those life experiences can push them into in different directions. So according to some of these experts, there isn't any such thing as free will whatsoever. But I have a bit of a different take. I looked at the research of Benjamin Libet in the 80s, John Dylan Hayes, I think in 2007, Isaac Fried in 2011, and they were looking at activity in the subconscious mind before you make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the subjects were asked to choose whether they were going to press a button with their right hand or their left hand. You know, that kind of choice is what they were working on. And what they found using fMRI or electrodes implanted in the brain was that there's activity in the subconscious mind up to 7 seconds before the choice is made. So that means a technician looking, you know, who's using fMRI, a technician looking at that can predict what it is that you're going to choose perhaps 7 seconds before you actually choose it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we looked at that information and said, okay, so the choice isn't coming from you, it's coming from your subconscious mind. So looking at your subconscious mind and the information in there, if there is any access to free will, it's your choice today to say, I'm going to take care of my subconscious mind. I'm going to choose how it gets programmed. Maybe I'm going to be more selective about the kind of entertainment that I consume. Maybe I'll be more careful about the kind of words that I use. I mean, they have found the power of words, certain words like pain and anger, and there's a response in the brain, and it's these things are just not healthy, whereas words like love and joy are just better for your system. But with free will, when you take charge of your subconscious mind, you take charge of that programming when you're aware that it has all of those beliefs in there, and so you can change them. So when it comes to self-destructive patterns, say, perhaps you've got the kind of personality that always gets into the wrong kind of relationship. You always choose the same kind of wrong partner. Well, you can change it, because a part of that is going to be a belief that you don't deserve any better, or it's going to be a belief that that is what a partner looks like, that is how you're supposed to behave. The fact that, you know, as I said, that's what relationships are supposed to look like. There's all of these ideas that are in your subconscious mind, and when you take charge of how it gets programmed, so if you're the kind of person that always enjoys chick flicks where the woman gets into trouble because, you know, the guy abuses her over and over,
mm-hmm.
these things just reinforce those kinds of beliefs. So when you start to change the input, change the kinds of stuff that you watch, change the type of communications that you have with your friends, like aging is a huge one. Aging is you know, there are lots of beliefs about as you get older you become weaker and more feeble and you can't do as much, and these things get repeated. The people around you can often say, people around me can often say, oh, we're getting to a certain age, we need to start taking it slower, we need to, and these things become a part of your subconscious programming. If you have the belief that, okay, I'm getting older, I need to slow down, so you slow down, so you don't use your body as much, and as such, your body gets stiff. It doesn't have the flexibility that it once had. It's not as fit as it once was. So when you change these ideas in your subconscious mind, and mind training does provide lots of tools as to how you actively change the programming in your subconscious mind. But the beautiful part about it, Ginger, that I took from this was that, you know, if Sapolsky and these other experts talk about everything having a precursor, well, my personality, your personality, and I would bet most of the people who are tuned into the show all have a belief that it's possible for us to do better. So they're already open to the idea of mind training and having tools and techniques for self-empowerment. They're open to the, to those kinds of ideas. But the more of these things you do, the more your own life changes. And as your life changes, that becomes part of somebody else's experience. Somebody watches you. They see where you came from. They see what you're achieving now. And they say, I want a bit of that. If that person can do it, then maybe I can too. So I don't buy into the fact that there isn't any such thing as free will. I will say that free will isn't free. You have to claim it. You have to actively do something. If you are working on automatic, you don't have free will. But when you stop and think about all of these ideas that you have, when you take charge of your own free will, then you have the ability to change your own life. And the spiritual aspect of that is that other people are influenced by your experiences. They watch the changes in you. And then perhaps there are other people out there who say, well, if they can do it, I can do it too. So they try techniques that they formerly would have dismissed. And then that chain reaction just continues. So I'm a big advocate of be the change that you want to see in the world. Take care of yourself, take self-responsibility for what is in your mind, take self-responsibility for your own life and the choices that you make, and that alone will have an effect. And so, yeah, I find that to be really spiritual, and that's to me the highlight of the argument about free will. It's not free, but you have the ability to turn it in a way that can be of great benefit.
Mm-hmm. And I love that. And one of the topics that you talked about that's very interesting that comes around a lot for, I think, any of us in the human experience is a lot or a significant part of the work that you do revolves around the idea of forgiveness. That's a big word when you think of the brevity of that. But can you expand on that some, and how do we forgive the unforgivable, like if someone's done something that we find unforgivable?
That is a big question. Yes, forgiveness is really, really important. Our work in that area began with some research that Progressive Awareness did at the Utah State Prison. They were trying to find ways to reduce hostility and aggression. Mm-hmm. And so they did, they interviewed lots of the inmates there. And one of the things that they found that was really common was this idea of blame. The inmates invariably blamed life, circumstances, others for the choices that they made. So, perhaps they blamed the fact that their mom was always out and mom had lots of boyfriends, dad didn't pay any attention. They just hung around with their friends next door and they got them into drugs, but they blamed everything else. Blame takes away all responsibility. So what we decided to do was when we were creating a special inner talk program for the Utah State Prison in order to reduce hostility and aggression, one of the things that we did was we incorporated the forgiveness set on the program. And the forgiveness set is basically, I forgive myself, I forgive all others, I am forgiven. When you hold on to blame, shame, and guilt, it eats away at you. It ties you up. You can't move forward out of it. But more importantly, Ginger, it takes away responsibility. When something is somebody else's fault, there's nothing you can do about it. When you turn that around and say, well, I am part of this equation, so therefore I can do something about it. So forgiveness is a huge part of the importance of forgiveness has to do with self-responsibility. But when it comes to forgiving the unforgivable, all of these ideas, like the idea of free will too, that isn't to say that someone who does something wrong, you know, if someone commits a crime or something, they should be punished. They should be put away to keep the rest of society safe. So I'm not talking about that aspect of it. I'm not saying, you know, you forgive someone, you hug them, you bring them back into your life, and you allow them to abuse you again. I'm not saying that at all. But when you understand these arguments about free will and the fact that everything has a precursor and the fact that lots of people are just fast asleep, they're not aware of how much control they have over their lives, they're acting on automatic, well, then you reach again another spiritual idea, forgive them, they know not what they do. Mm-hmm. And that to me has been really helpful. You know, we all encounter people at times like, why did that person treat me so badly? And, you know, you can hold on to it. But when you just forgive them and release it, because it's not their time. It's not their time right now to learn these type of concepts. You forgive them because they don't know any better. So that's how you do it. And that frees you up to move forward and get on with your life so that you can focus on what brings you joy rather than what brought you pain yesterday.
I love that, Ravinder, and that is so beautifully said. And unfortunately, we've run out of time. I've had such a great time connecting with you, sharing with the viewers your comprehensive, informative book that has practical tools and very applicable to daily life that they can use. But before we go, I would like for you to share with the listeners, how can they find you and where can they purchase your book?
Mind Training, The Science of Self-Empowerment is available at all bookstores. If your bookstore doesn't have it in stock, they can order it. You can order it online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of your favorite places. To learn more about me and the work that I do and to connect with me, I would ask that you visit my website. That is ravindertaylor.com. Just ravindertaylor.com. You can, as I said, learn more about me and all the fun things that we do.
I love it. And again, Ravinder, thank you so much for joining us and the listeners sharing your book. And just thank you so much. And thanks to all the listeners for tuning in. Bye-bye, everyone.